Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. CNN anchor and chief Washington correspondent and New York Times bestselling author Jake Tapper's new thriller, The Devil May Dance, is set in the Rat Pack world of early 1960s Hollywood. In the sequel to Tapper's The Hellfire Club, the fictional New York Congressman Charlie Martyr and his zoologist wife Margaret are sucked into an investigation involving Hollywood and the mob by Attorney General Robert Kennedy. There, they mix it up with Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., Dean Martin, and JFK's brother-in-law, Peter Lawford. Jake Tapper is the author of The Hellfire Club, which is being turned into a TV series by HBO Max, and The Outpost, which became a film released in 2020. He is the anchor of The Lead with Jake Tapper on CNN weekday afternoons from 4 to 6, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Philadelphia's own Jake Tapper to this week's book show. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing? I'm glad to be back, hopefully next time in person.
I remember saying to you, I hope to goodness you're working on another one, and you said you were, and here it is. And did it take you longer than you expected it?
No. I had learned a lot of lessons, I think, from the first one, writing lessons, in terms of what I think Faulkner called killing your darlings, the idea of editing out stuff, even if you like it, just for the sake of narrative. And so the first one took longer. This one, I wouldn't say it was easy. Writing a novel is not easy. It was a little bit smoother of a process. And also, I have to say, in a twisted way, I benefited from the pandemic in that for the first time in an election year, I only did two work trips. And from April till August, I had zero commute because I was broadcasting from home. So I actually had more time on my hands than I normally would. While I originally, before the pandemic hit, I was worried about making deadline, I actually didn't end up having a problem.
You know, I didn't think about the travel aspect of it because I was going to ask you, because it seemed for the last year and a half, and I hope you take this as the compliment I mean it to be, but you were on my television all the time. And
yeah.
Because, look, we had a pandemic, we had a presidential election, we had an insurrection, all this stuff was going on, and there you were. And meanwhile, you get to write the book. Do you have to task yourself to say, okay, I'm going to write this much every day?
That's exactly how I do it. And just saying to my wife, I'm sure there are a lot of aspiring novelists listening to your show right now. And I don't think I am a better writer or a better storyteller or more creative than anyone. I think that I am a worker bee and I think I am disciplined. And what I do is when I'm in the middle of a writing project, I make myself write every day for a minimum of 15 minutes. And that way, if at the end of the week, all I did was the minimum, that's an hour 45 under my belt. That's three or four pages. It's something. So, I mean, that is just my advice for anybody who is a frustrated writer. Writers write. You need to sit down and you need to commit in the same way you would commit to keeping in touch with your mom or doing cardio 5 days a week or whatever, you know, going to church, whatever right. It is, whatever commitment you make that to your writing as well.
You know, it seems, and back to your earlier point of that nothing about writing a novel is easy, and this is certainly as hard. But with that said, this reads to be so much fun. I can only assume that there were very fun aspects of writing it.
That is 100% true. Yes, 100%. I mean, there were some frustrated weeks where I felt like I'd written myself into a corner and that sort of thing. But generally speaking, especially in the middle of the pandemic and the very nasty presidential campaign, it was nice to be able to leave 2020 America and spend some time in Hollywood in 1962 with the Rat Pack. It was enjoyable. And, you know, one of the things about writing fiction is, you and nonfiction too, for that matter, is you picture things in your head and you spend so much time with those scenes that they become almost like memory. I think there's a line in Hamilton, I imagine death so much, it's almost like a memory. And it's like that. I just have very vivid memories of my imagination of spending time at a restaurant with the Rat Pack, at the Hollywood sign, at the Oscars, in Vegas, etc. So yeah, I mean, it was fun to do that. Absolutely.
You know, I think you and I are just about the same age. You're about a year younger, which is early 50s. And I only bring that up because the Rat Pack was sort of on the decline as we were growing up. They were, you know, they were making a couple of appearances with Johnny Carson and showing up on a couch every once in a while. They'd come out and sing to Dinah Shore. But, you know, the heyday had passed. So what interested you to want to go back to a time that even that you hadn't lived through, that you weren't familiar with?
Well, I mean, first of all, you're completely right. I mean, the Rat Pack had kind of descended into self-caricature by the time that you and I were aware of them. Sammy Davis Jr. and Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin were more, you were more likely to see them being satirized on Saturday Night Live than you were to actually see them, at least in my experience. And they were the, you know, later bloated versions, toupee versions of themselves. I was inspired to write this book because when I was doing promotion for the Hellfire Club, the first book in the series, I realized, oh, this people are reading this, people are buying this. I could probably write a sequel. And around that time, I heard this crazy story that was true, which was that after campaigning their hearts out for JFK in 1960, the Rat Pack and Sinatra thought that they now enjoyed benefits. And Sinatra thought that President John F. Kennedy was going to come stay with him when Kennedy came out to California. And Sinatra had all this work done to his compound in Rancho Mirage. He had a helipad built. He had phone lines installed. He had rooms built. I mean, he really was preparing for a presidential visit. And then what happened was Sinatra's connection to the family, his closest connection to the family, Ambassador Kennedy, had a stroke in December 1961. And Attorney General Robert Kennedy, who was going after organized crime as the Attorney General, was confronted with the fact that Sinatra was friends with some of the people he was investigating. So Attorney General Kennedy had to decide, well, do I offend this huge Hollywood star who helped get my brother elected, or do I let my brother, the president, sleep in a bed that Sam Giancana may have slept in? And that's a true story. That really happened. And, you know, I'm fairly knowledgeable about both politics and pop culture, and I did not know that story. So I was like, wow. And this would be a great setting for Charlie and Margaret. And so that's how it happened. And I have to say, the Rat Pack in 1961-62 was a lot cooler than the Rat Pack that you and I were exposed to.
The bedraggled Rat Pack.
Yeah. The bloated toupee version. Well, I mean, to be fair, I mean, I'm sure I was much better and, you know, younger in my day than the bloated toupee version of myself. But still, I mean, they were cool. They were cool characters. I mean, Ocean's 11, the original movie with Sinatra and the Rat Pack, is a horrible movie. But imagine the coolness of the guys from the remake.
Right.
Imagine the coolness of if Matt Damon and George Clooney and Brad Pitt and all those guys actually were best friends and actually hung out. That's what the Rat Pack was like.
Two things I want to get to right real quick. One is there's a great line in the book, and toward the end where Robert Kennedy, the characters, your characters, Charlie and Margaret, say, well, by not having the president come to Sinatra's house, you know, you're really dissing Frank. And Kennedy says, well, what's he going to do? Vote for Reagan? Well, right. And then he does, right? I mean, you don't say that, but that's exactly what he did. And it's really interesting. You draw that path.
Having nothing to do with my book, I think you can draw a direct line between the Kennedy-Sinatra breakup in 1962. I think you can draw a direct line between that and Sinatra becoming a Reagan friend in the late 70s and early 80s. And actually, Karen Tumulty has a great book out, I think, about Nancy Reagan. And in the book, she's talking about how Sinatra was going to apply to be on like a White House board, to be like a cultural minister for the Reagan White House. And some Reagan aides were trying to figure out how to stop it. And so I forget who it was. It was Mike Deaver or Larry Speaks or one of these Reagan aides says to Sinatra, okay, yeah, as soon as you're done with the FBI background check, you know, you'll come in and we'll get this going. It's going to be great. And Sinatra's like, what? And then again, the FBI background check, they have to look into your background. They have to do a thorough investigation. You understand. And that was the end of that.
Jake Tapper is our guest. The name of the new book is The Devil May Dance. Talking about films, this book revolves around the whole reason that Charlie and Margaret, well, the reason is they're on assignment, but the fake reason is that they are helping Frank Sinatra make the Manchurian Candidate as far as details.
Yeah, that's the fake reason. And Robert Kennedy comes up with that because they are shooting, which actually the timing worked out perfectly. They are actually shooting the Manchurian Candidate. And the Kennedys were friends with Arthur Krim, the head of United Artists, who was a big Democratic fundraiser and advisor as well. And in fact, in real life, to get the Manchurian Candidate made, Sinatra had to appeal to President Kennedy to lean on Krim, because Krim was worried that the movie was so full of weird conspiracies and communism and all the insanity of that film, which is a nutty film, that it would hurt Kennedy for some reason. And so Sinatra went, this is not from the book, this is real life. Sinatra goes to Kennedy and says, I need help. We want to make the Manchurian Candidate. This had been a very successful novel in 1959 by Richard Condon. And Kennedy's reaction is like, oh, great, who's going to play the mother? Because the mother, played by Angela Lansbury in the film, it's an incestuous relationship she has with her son, played by Lawrence Harvey, who Raymond Shaw. Anyway, the movie's not as intimate and gross as the book, but that's how much Kennedy was a student of pop culture. And he leaned on Krim, and Krim had the film made. But in the book, Robert Kennedy just asks Krim to make Charlie a consultant, because he's both a politician and a war hero, like the character of Bennett Marco that Sinatra plays in The Manchurian Candidate, which is a weird movie. I just watched it again Sunday night. I did an event with Criterion where I just tweeted about the film, and we had a watch along party, and it's a trippy, trippy film.
It is a weird movie. The other thing I think that I kept on coming back to, you read this and you look at this guy, Charlie Martyr, who you've created, and he's a war hero. He comes out of the war. He has his issues. There's PTSD. He has problems drinking. He's found this amazing woman to be his wife, who is a zoologist, who is very patient with all that's going on. And you think to yourself, well, yeah, this is the kind of guy, this Republican congressman, this is the kind of guy that I would want representing me in the district. And you read this, and I don't care whether you're reading about the 50s or the 60s, and you think, wow, this is a great guy. And then I put the book down and I turn on your show and you're talking about Matt Gaetz. Man, we've come a long way.
Well, he's an Eisenhower. Charlie's an Eisenhower Republican. He's a Rockefeller Republican. You know, I guess in today's world, he would be an Adam Kinzinger Republican. There are some good folks in that party. It's going through a really rough time right now because of how enthralled it is to Trump's lies about the election and this narrative, this fictional narrative. But I still have hopes for the Republican Party that there's a Charlie Martyr or two in there that can come and save them.
So, speaking of politicians who have sex with minors, you talk about that in the
That's this quite is, a segue.
Yes, I know. I broadcasting great there. It's a moment in the book where there is this conspiracy going on, and this horrible thing that's happening at Disneyland of all places. Again, something you made up. Let's make that very
to be
clear.
Yeah.
Yes.
No. There were no orgies at Disneyland that I know of.
Correct.
That did not happen.
But what's interesting is that the and I only learned this in reading a review of your book, that there's an actual line that you use, these basically studio heads who are setting up actors so they can have sex with minors, and you actually use a line from Jeffrey Epstein.
Well, it's a line that Donald Trump made about Jeffrey Epstein.
Well, that's even better.
From before the scandal, it's something along the lines of, it said he likes young girls even more than I do. Yeah, I mean, look, here's the thing. To write about Hollywood, with any honesty, is to write about how Hollywood regards women. And to write about how Hollywood regards women is to write about how they value youth, often to the point of liking 16, 17 year old girls, not women, girls. And that is a subtext of the book, just as it's, you know, part of the plot is, well, I don't want to ruin anything, but, you know, Margaret goes out there and she has a niece who is missing and, you know, turns up in Hollywood, and rescuing her niece becomes one of Margaret's plot points while she's out there. Look, I mean, one of the things that's very clear about Hollywood now and Hollywood then is the casual misogyny and abuse of women. And, you know, whether we're talking about Harvey Weinstein or Hollywood stars back then. I mean, it's funny, you know, Errol Flynn is a legend, but remember, he went to jail for, or he was on trial rather, for statutory rape. And like, society took his side back then. So, I mean, hopefully not in too heavy-handed a way, but I mean, the idea of the exploitation of girls and women being part of the culture, period, but especially in Hollywood, is definitely part of it. And yeah, and I used the quote of Trump talking about Jeffrey Epstein just because I thought, like, things don't change. They don't.
It's interesting because even the people who got away with it, like Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah. During this, I mean, there's so much of the timing of these things is just so serendipitous. Like, you know, when I was writing the book and I'd be like, well, what happened during this era that I can play with? When I say era, I mean like from December 1961 to May 1962. That's, you know, that's the 6 months that I'm writing about. You know, I just go on newspapers.com and just start reading old newspapers. And, you know, there'd be like the death of a famous lawyer who had been a lawyer who got mobsters off and also got Charlie Chaplin off and Errol Flynn. I mean, you know, that just happened to be there. And, you know, there's a lot of overlap because there are a lot of scumbags in Hollywood.
Well, and on that note, in writing about the Rat Pack, these are not stellar, sterling people. I mean, the moments are cringeworthy. There are many of them, and they do not live an exemplary life in any way, shape, or form. And it's interesting in two ways. Of course, one is just the actual behavior, and the other, of course, is how your characters look at this and are just, I'm sorry, people live this way? This is how this happens. And it's quite striking.
One of the challenges about writing about this era is that the casual sexism and racism was just so prevalent among the Rat Pack. Even though Sinatra was actually, you know, a real crusader for civil rights in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, you know, the casual racism that they would demonstrate on stage, not so much behind the scenes to Sammy Davis Jr., but on stage to Sammy Davis Jr., or just the casual misogyny and sexism when it came to women, which I don't think would surprise anybody. Not that John F. Kennedy was, you know, winning any awards for that either. You know, one of the challenges is to write about it while also not glamorizing it, even though glamorous people are doing it and saying it, and also making it clear that as the author, I don't approve of it. I don't think it's cool, right. but this is how it was. So Charlie and Margaret were helpful, especially Margaret, who has a real moral center, in you know, objecting to it in their minds, at least, if not public, if not in spoken, while also representing what really was going on. And, you know, the book opens, Charlie and Margaret are with the Rat Pack in the middle of the night, and they're all, you know, a little tipsy, and they're running around Forest Lawn Cemetery. They're honoring the death of a different star who had died in a car crash a few weeks before. Again, a true story. And, you know, they're kind of brutes.
The misogyny and the racism aside, though, there is a couple sections here where your writing of profanity is just great. Man, you string together. There's some Sinatra moments there. Good for you. I just sort of envisioned. I thought, my goodness, that's great. I wonder if that's like a Wolf Blitzer production meeting. What's that?
Wolf is a very kind and sweet man. There's yeah. I mean, look. I mean, profanity had to. The profanity actually. I dialed back some of the profanity that actually had been used in real life for the book, but then I dialed up other profanity. Profanity is actually a plot point. One specific word,
right?
That is used to ingratiate with Frank, and then also is part of a climax where Frank where there's a revelation. I felt like profanity was a plot point in some ways, a necessary one.
Jake Tapper is our guest. The name of the book is The Devil May Dance. Margaret, we should note, really is, as you say, a moral center, but very much our feminist hero in this. She is a doctor. She is a zoologist, which comes into the book because she learns and knows a thing or two about birds, which play a part in this.
They're filming the birds. They're filming the Hitchcock movie, The Birds, during this period.
I never knew, what is it, a conspiracy of ravens? I didn't know that was, it's a gaggle of geese and a conspiracy of ravens. I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a whole list. I don't know it. Margaret knows it. So she has a murder of crows. There's a bird trainer that Margaret meets and befriends in Hollywood, because Margaret's a zoologist and an expert on horses, but is intrigued by, because obviously there are animal trainers in Hollywood, and Hitchcock was filming The Birds in 1962. And so I thought that that would be an interesting part, that Margaret would be intrigued to meet another woman who is an expert on a different kind of animal. And yes, it does become significant at a different point in the book. But yeah, I can't rattle it off like they do. That's one of the great things about writing, is that you can have your characters be much smarter and more clever than you ever can hope to be.
It is, of course, a work of fiction. You make that clear. But there are, because you're dealing with real people and real time and events, you list these sources, which, by the way, is very nice of you. But also, it gives an idea of what you referred to get much of your information, which I thought was really interesting.
Well, first of all, I mean, there are a bunch of great books that I read that I really relied on and took material from, because they were recording nonfiction and I'm, you know, writing a historical novel. And I wanted to make sure that people like James Kaplan, who wrote these two volume biography of Sinatra and others, got their due. Second of all, just like as a nerd, I know that when I'm watching historical fiction, I always am like headed to Google to find out what's real, what's not real. You know, there are a bunch of little, I wouldn't call them Easter eggs, but things throughout the book that are real, whether having to do with Greensboro, North Carolina, and an incident that happened there in 1961, or other events that I know will, for my fellow nerds, be fun. Because so much of the book was just me having fun with history. And, right. You know, when I would hit with, you know, one of the things I wanted to do in this book that I was make sure that everything took place in a cool place, every scene in a cool place. And so sometimes I'd be like, well, I need to start this chapter with something and I don't know what's going on. Like, where can I start it? And I would just, again, go to newspapers.com and find out, oh, Dodger Stadium opened right that day. Oh, great. I'll set something there.
You take a swipe at the Church of Scientology in this book, and I say swipe only because it's a plot point where they are involved in this, and it's the very beginning. L. Ron Hubbard is still with us at this time, but the church is starting to have an impact in Hollywood.
Recruiting famous stars was something that L. Ron Hubbard wanted to do from the 50s. And I read a couple biographies. I read a biography of L. Ron Hubbard, and then I read also Going Clear by Lawrence Wright and some other books. And look, people can believe what they want to believe, and we have freedom of religion in this country and all that. But, you know, there's some interesting stuff that happened with the Church of Scientology in Hollywood. And to write about Hollywood in 1962 and not have the Church of Scientology seemed like a missed opportunity.
When you look at these characters that you have so firmly established now, is it obvious to say, well, yes, we'll take them somewhere else?
I think I'll take them to the 70s for a third. But I'm kind of inclined to have Charlie and Margaret's son, Dwight, whose nickname would be Ike, take the lead in the 70s. He would be 18, 19 years old in the mid to late 70s. And I think that might be more fun. Charlie and Margaret will be in their 50s. I'm in my 50s. I don't know how much of an adventure I'm up for these days. You literally have to pay me to leave my house. So it might be more fun to have a young, not an anti-hero, but maybe a young, little bit more brash, less sainted main character than Charlie and Margaret.
You certainly are on the periphery of, in this book and in the previous, the Hellfire Club, in taking every once in a while a look at the press and certainly the tabloid press in this book. Is that of interest, or is the whole idea of this for you to get away from the 9-to-5 job?
No, it's interesting because the reporters don't come across well, even though I have, you know, I'm a journalist and right. I revere journalism, but reporters don't come across well in these books. And that's mainly because the main characters are people who would hate the press, politicians, and in this book, also Hollywood stars. But it's not a commentary necessarily about the press so much as just it would feel wrong to have members of Congress or Hollywood celebrities think good things about us because we are exist to be pains in their butts. But I think the journalists might be more heroic in the third book.
It's amazing to me that we all have lived through the past year and a half with all of its trials and tribulations, and that you can that you would even find time to be able to do this, because it seemed like we were all just glued trying to figure out what was happening next. And now, like, if this book came out from a year from now and you said, oh, well, yeah, finally things calmed down a little bit, I could write, that would make more sense to me.
It was a great escape for me, Joe. I mean, it was really just a great escape. It was just an opportunity to get away from everything. It was fun to write, and I felt like as I was writing it, like, this will be something that people can read and really have fun with. They can really enjoy, and they'll be able to escape too. And so I wouldn't say it was an altruistic venture, but I felt like people will like this. People will be able to escape.
The new book is an absolute delight. It is The Devil May Dance. It is by Jake Tapper. It is a sequel to The Hellfire Club. You don't have to have read The Hellfire Club, but it wouldn't hurt. Published by Little Brown. Jake Tapper, a great pleasure to have you on the program as always.
It's always great, Joe. Thank you so much.
Be well. Again, Jake Tapper's new book is The Devil May Dance. It is published by Little Brown. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.